Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning, Steve Williamson here. Mike Costantino is taking the day off. I have two people in the studio. Sitting across from me is my brother, Chuck. He worked in the banking industry from the time he returned to from Vietnam, where he worked for the Army version of the NSA. He managed multi-million dollar bank portfolios of bonds and stuff. Did a lot of lobbying for the bank industry. And we have Bill Timmerman, who's been on many times before. And Bill graduated summa cum laude. He speaks 28 languages. Anyway, with these two folks, we're going to talk about extraction, but we're really talking about government subsidies. So all the focus, you know, is on welfare and how much money that cost and how much money different kinds of programs, food stamps cost and so forth and so on. But the biggest subsidies in the United States, as I think you're going to hear today, are to businesses. And they're often subsidies that are generated by an elaborate set of lobbyists. Both Democrats and Republicans use the former members of Congress and their associates to extract money from the taxpayer, essentially. Chuck, tell us a little bit about the general thing, and then we're going to take up, Bill's going to talk about a major retailer, Walmart, and how Walmart structures its payments to its employees in such a way as to extract nice subsidies from the U.S. government and us taxpayers.
Yes, thanks, Steve. Well, one man's subsidy is another man's good idea. So it's not clear until usually after the fact whether a subsidy or something helpful provided a useful benefit to society or not. But there have been various measurements of the total amount spent. The Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank, estimates that subsidies are at least $100 billion a year. I've seen other literature that counted as $170 billion. But part of the difference is, what do you include as a subsidy? So subsidies that we're talking about generally include direct money grants, like sometimes like farmers get to not grow crops and so on. Tax breaks, which is the most subtle and almost impossible to determine size, and that's the reason these estimates vary so great, because you don't see a corporate tax return. It's private in the United States and can't be disclosed. And then they can be anti-competitive rules that keep other people outside of your business from entering it. And there can be economic development.
Well, we have free enterprise here.
Yes, well, of course, I spent my whole career in business, and our main objective was to prevent other people entering areas where we were already had big market share. So the idea of business is to get yourself an advantage, but not to just make it easy for everyone to compete with you. So that's sort of backwards. So the subsidy category includes a broad number of things, some of which are socially good and some of which are not. For example, FDIC insurance on deposits up to $250,000 is generally paid for by an assessment on the bank, but it has an implied guarantee by the federal government. We saw that during the S&L crisis, when the S&L fund to bail out the S&Ls in the 80s was inadequate. They just merged the two funds. So there's an implied guarantee to all the deposit insurance and many other things. Well, it's probably a good thing to have that implied deal, but it does make the cost of banking lower. It subsidizes banking.
So banks don't have to worry about covering that because the federal government will step in with taxpayers.
In the worst case scenario, they did once before. And so you see with the bailout of the banks in the recent financial crisis, you see that there is an implied guarantee to the largest banks. So those are a kind of subsidy as well.
So Bill's going to talk about, I guess, the largest retailer in the United States And I believe they sell now 23%, something like that, of the food sold in the United States. We don't even think of them generally as selling food. And that's Walmart, Bill.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, when I look at this, you know, just in, to make a few general remarks here to begin, is that what we're talking about when we're talking about you know, who gets the benefit of tax expenditures, you know, who has a claim on the taxpayer's contribution to the government. It's really what we're talking about is A, a matter of priorities, B, a matter of justice, and three, a matter of incentives. Some of the incentives that we see are pretty perverse. I mean, just to give you an example, if you accept some of these figures that corporate welfare, that is to say corporate claims on tax revenues, are $170 billion, you can go back to like 1986, for example, and you could see that the federal government spent $11 billion on aid to dependent children, which was the welfare program then. Medicare cost government $30 billion, and all of that was about half the amount that corporations received each year through assorted tax breaks. The federal program for the disabled received $13 billion from the federal government, and American businesses were given $17 billion in direct aid. So if you're talking about reducing the federal budget, what you're looking at, what you hear talked about, particularly by Republicans, but also by Democrats as well, is that we have to reduce social welfare payments. But when you look at it, our payments to corporations far exceed the payments to individuals, and, we should look more closely at that. Now, just to give you an example, we can talk about Walmart, which is the world's second largest public corporation, the biggest private employer in the world. It has over 2 million employees, and it operates in 15 countries. And it's the largest retailer in the world. It has about 4,500 stores in the U.S. alone, if you count Sam's Club and so forth. And One of the things that people have noticed lately is that Walmart salaries and benefits are very low compared to other retailers in the same market sector, people like Target and Costco. And in fact,
and then that puts pressure on Costco and Target not to raise wages because they're being undercut by Walmart.
Well, yes, it has secondary effects like that too. But in 2004, some folks from the University of California at the Berkeley Center for Labor Education and Research did a study to find out just exactly how much the federal government contributed to Walmart's profits by subsidizing their labor force. And what they discovered is that the hidden cost of the Walmart jobs the cost that Walmart wasn't paying, that the federal government was picking up, was enormous. Walmart employees earned an average of 31% less than workers employed in other large retail firms, and they were receiving an average wage of $9.70 an hour compared to the $14 an hour average hourly earnings for employees in other large retail firms. We're talking about firms with 1,000 or more employees. And 23% fewer Walmart workers were covered by employer-sponsored health insurance than large retail workers as a whole. The differences are even greater when Walmart workers were compared to unionized grocery workers. In the San Francisco Bay Area, non-managerial Walmart employees earned on average $9.40 an hour compared to $15.31 for unionized grocery workers. 39% less, and were half as likely to have health benefits. And At these low wages, many Walmart workers relied on public safety net programs, food stamps, Medi-Cal, that's the California Medicaid variant. And this study was done largely in California, but other studies in places like Georgia and Florida and so forth have confirmed these results. So they were relying on government programs basically to keep their employees' body and soul together.
So here the people are employed full time.
Yes.
And they're not making a living wage, and they're making so little money that they need, you know, all kinds of support from food stamps, or they call that SNAP now, and so forth and so on. So it costs billions of dollars that the taxpayers are paying, and that's what you're calling the subsidy?
Yeah, in California, the cost of the taxpayers of benefits supplied to Walmart workers because of their low wages were estimated at $86 million a year. And nationwide, about $450 million. This is federal tax money being used to support workers in Walmart who couldn't buy what they needed to keep their families alive on what they were making at Walmart.
So they're externalizing some of their labor costs onto the public.
Onto the taxpayer, exactly right. And, even Walmart internal memos say this. Their New York Times quoted a Walmart internal memo that said very clearly that 27% of their associates' children were on federal welfare supplemental aid. 22% of them were on Medicaid.
So if you go over to Costco, this is not happening.
This is not happening because the wages are higher, basically. I mean, the number of their employees that seek federal benefits is far lower.
But isn't that lowering wages in general and benefits in general?
Well, there has to be a reason why Walmart is the largest retail employer in the world. It's because they can charge lower prices for the same goods. For one reason, because they're paying their labor costs are lower. There are other reasons, but that's a big reason, is that they have forced wages down far enough, and they even recommend to their own employees, when their own employees say, I can't live on this salary, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that they're telling their employees to apply for the federal programs. They're not telling them, we'll raise your wages, they're telling them, go seek government aid. So the real question is, if you're going to talk about federal welfare programs, Are we subsidizing the poor or low wage workers, or are we subsidizing Walmart Incorporated? That's a real question.
So to an extent, the workers are getting basically part of their benefits from the federal government, and that's what you're calling a subsidy, because that part, however big it is, billions of dollars maybe over a decade, that is money that Walmart doesn't have to pay. That's been externalized onto the taxpayers.
They can either take it out in profits to the Walton family, because it's a family-owned business.
Yeah.
Or they can use it to pay lower wages and increase their market share. I mean, when a Walmart comes into a town, their low prices very often shut down smaller businesses into bankruptcy who can't compete with the prices. But at the same time, they're paying the people who go to work at Walmart in that town so little that they have to rely on government benefits to keep themselves alive.
But the positive side is they're bringing a cheaper merchandise. What would you say about
that? Well, if you're not making as much money, you need cheaper merchandise, but it becomes circular. It becomes a kind of race to the bottom. I mean, if we're really concerned about reducing the size of government, if we're really concerned about the cost to the taxpayer of government benefit programs, and as conservatives claim we ought to be, why aren't we more concerned about the low wages paid by Walmart and also by fast food franchises, chains like McDonald's, who also pay wages below living wage? Why should we, as taxpayers, subsidize a corporate business model
Because then we get cheap hamburgers.
Which relies in part for its profits on forcing its employees onto the state and federal welfare rolls. You know, why aren't they carrying their own weight in this area? It's a question I think we ought to ask ourselves.
Read my lips. Cheap hamburgers. That's the reason. Chuck, do you have anything to add on Walmart? Bill's talking about this huge corporation that whose employees are basically they're externalizing all their costs on a lot of time for medical care onto the federal government, to federal programs, right?
It's true. You could call that a subsidy, and there are many variations of subsidies. But the underlying reality is you have lobbying efforts that keep things as they are, and you don't have unions at Walmart, which is the main difference between unions and between Walmart and Safeway prices is they have lower costs. But they're heavily subsidized in other ways, too. All the infrastructure that delivers those goods to the local Walmart is government-funded. The Port of Long Beach, where they're delivering the activity, all these products from China are being shipped in. The highways that the trucks are bringing it from. So every business has a huge set of subsidies. The underlying question is, are they fair? Are they good for the whole country or not? I think it would clearly be better for the country if Walmart employees were paid enough so they weren't eligible for the SNAP program. It's crazy. But I don't know that I believe the government should intervene and force that. I think that the employees need to unionize.
Well, there's another point I would like to make here, and that is that once a company gets as large as Walmart, it's very, very difficult to get legislation through Congress that would change the incentives. Remember, every government subsidy is defended by an interest group. And the problem is that for a number of years now, since the 1980s, the power of unions to influence legislation has been declining, and the power of corporations has been increasing. So if you think it's not a good idea for Walmart to pay people $9 an hour and then send them to apply for food stamps, passing legislation that would change those incentives so that they would see it in their interest to pay higher salaries is extremely difficult because Walmart is a very powerful lobby.
Also, they've been willing to close stores rather than unionize or raise wages, right? They've closed several stores down. The other thing is that I was seeing a program, and they're opening two stores. I think it was in D.C. or New York City, and they have, say, 400 jobs, and they have 23,000 applicants for the jobs. And that is, people are generally making very low wages around the country. I mean, there's a whole category of people that we really don't talk about who are full-time workers who don't really make a living wage. And would you agree that's a serious problem?
We have more, about three times as many people looking for work right now as there are job openings. So obviously the pressure varies by region, but it's really on the person looking for work as opposed to on the employer because there's a three for one. Now, they're not necessarily a fit with the openings you have, and that's why you still have openings, even though you have three times as many people unemployed as you do. But getting that ratio down, improving unemployment, will improve wages. It's a cause and effect.
It's going to be hard to create enough demand to raise employment if you're not paying the people you expect to buy your products a living wage.
Yeah. Chuck and I saw what Walmart did to our little town in Oklahoma, and the downtown business section sort of collapsed, and they did have cheaper wages, and people started going out to their giant efficient parking lots and everything else. So it does have an impact, but people kind of have gotten to kind of accept that. We're from Oklahoma, and we wanted Chuck to talk a little bit about what we call extractive industries, oil, gas, hard rock mining, and coal. Because if you think Walmart is the only group getting subsidized, you're in for a surprise.
Yes, it's probably true that the extraction industries are the most heavily subsidized in the United States. But one interesting thing, Steve, if you and I and Bill go up to the San Francisco Peaks and prospect for gold and find it, our claim will cost us $2.50 to $5 to file, and we don't have to pay any royalties on that, even though it's on public land. So the we're still under the 1872 General Mining Act of 1872, which was signed by Ulysses Grant, and it still applies. And what it says is the first most important use of public lands in the West, unless they're in designated wilderness or a national monument or park, is extraction mining. So it doesn't matter that you want to go ride your horse or your ATV or whatever else in that area. I can pay $2.50 and claim it and mine the hell out of it. And I don't have to pay any royalties at all. If it were private property, I'd have to buy the mineral rights from you at fair market. And so the biggest subsidy right now is to that, and that's the issue we see going on up at the Grand Canyon, where there's claims for uranium mining. They really have precedent over recreational uses. So areas that are not in the national park, if they want to mine it, it's going to be a tough fight, and the legislature would have to overrule or change this act to stop mining.
Why hasn't it been changed, Chuck, in all these years? It's 1872. I mean, really, $2.50. People are not even going to believe it.
Yes,
but I know.
So it has been modified slightly, but it didn't take away that price. It didn't increase the price. So there was a modification in 1972, the Federal Land Management Policy Act, which did some things to make you restore the land after you strip mine it or whatever, but there's still, it's still the priority claim. So there's a river in Oregon, the Chetico River, which is a wild and scenic free flowing river in southern Oregon, but they're looking at filing a claim, or there has been a claim filed that's been litigated up in the headwaters for gold mining. And how they mine for gold is they take the water out of the river and they squirt it through giant hoses, and the end result is you tear down the mountain. Well, of course, that Salmon River will be gone within the first few months of doing it because of the pollution and the stuff in the river. So, but it still has priority. It takes very concerted effort or a congressional act to stop them from doing that.
So why why hasn't that been changed?
Because
it's an obvious
rip-off. Because they have very good lobbyists. So the whole extraction industry, it doesn't have the highest number of lobbyists, but it has some of the best paid lobbyists. And they also have presence in so many states where the Senate has blocked action. So the House has passed royalty legislation that would require them, if they take public lands and mine it, they would at least have to pay a royalty to the federal government. But that didn't pass the Senate because there's just enough influence, enough states have mining to prevent it.
Well, there's one thing I'd like to say, too, and that is that they get whatever it is they're pulling out of the ground, whether it's oil or uranium or gold or whatever it is, they get that essentially for free from what is, after all, commonly owned by all the people of the United States. We do this in the interest of development and developing our economy. That was the original purpose and original justification, and it makes a lot of sense. But now you've got a situation where, okay, they get it for free, they pull it out of the ground, they leave a wasteland behind, and guess if there's any cleanup done or any restoration of the environment following these forms of extraction. That is paid for by guess who? The taxpayers, individual taxpayers. It's not paid for by the companies or by a company consort, a group of companies. It's paid for by the taxpayers. So you get a double whammy here. They extract the stuff, make the profit, go away, and we pick up the pieces.
And then that differs from hard rock mining, differs from the petroleum industry and the coal industry. In most of those cases, it's competitively bid. So if they're going to lease the oil rights to the Santa Barbara Channel, well, part of that is a national park, and they couldn't. But any part that's not, they could if they just chose to. They do competitive bids and let any oil company bid on it. So the hard rock mining doesn't have that. If everybody knows there's gold in them their hills, it's the guy that gets first that files the claim that gets it with no royalties. And the proposal that failed in the Senate about 10 years ago would have charged 4% royalty on the old mining claims and 8% on new ones for the people who actually own the land. But anyway, that failed. It never got to the Senate.
I tell people when we're walking in the national forest, I said, this all belongs to us. You have a 300 million share in all of this because it's slightly diluted by the number of people.
But,
so you think the most shocking one is hard rock mining, which is gold, silver.
Yes.
We don't have diamonds.
The subsidies are more complicated in the petroleum industry. What you have there is you basically subsidize it mostly through taxes, because the way they treat extraction industries outside of the gold is you have an asset, and as you extract the oil or the coal, you get to depreciate it. So you get the cash flow from selling the product, but you don't actually have to pay taxes because you've depreciated the value of what's the pool is left. And of course, then you get to reevaluate that every few years because you get to go back and say, oh, we have secondary extraction methods. It's now worth X billion dollars more, so I'll depreciate that too. So in effect, you never end up paying taxes on money you extract from most of those industries.
We used to laugh about the oil subsidies when we were growing up in Oklahoma because they were such a joke, and everybody in Oklahoma was in favor of them, of course, or most people were in favor of them, but at the same time, we knew they were a boondoggle then because, like, how much harder is it to make something than just to extract something? I mean, if you're making, say, widgets, something simple, you have to keep making them. You have a plant, you have employees and stuff. Once you cap your oil well, it just keeps pumping oil. Yes. You have to pick it up.
You just put that pumper jack on it, and it just goes on for decades. Yeah. So in states like Oklahoma, where we grew up, now I can't speak now because I haven't even been there in a decade, but Texas, Oklahoma, or coal mining states like the Virginias, the state legislatures are very much in favor of the extraction industries, of course, because they're heavily backed by the extraction. So it causes a lot of employment. So the biggest subsidy for the petroleum industry is not in the price of the land that is competitively bid, but there are many other things that are held in common that eminent domain is used for and so on. I think it's funny that if you own land, but you don't own the minerals, you should have lived near that state capital of Oklahoma back in the 1930s, because some of the biggest mansions in the city were around the state capital. They didn't own the minerals, and pretty soon they had oil wells going up in their yard, and they got nothing from it. So the priority of extraction industries over other uses of the land is very high. Not as much as in the hard rock mining, but very high.
Yeah. We've talked about Walmart, a huge retailer, and we've talked about extractive industries, and we could spend a whole program on each one of these. We probably should at some point. But Bill wanted to talk about another industry, the defense industry, and the subsidies to the defense industry, because people may think, well, the defense industry is kind of out of control. We're building helicopters. We're never going to fly and this and that. But what about subsidies? This is also part of this picture, Bill?
Well, yes. It's, you know, when I talk about perverse incentives, the Defense Department is the first thing that springs to mind. You know, during World War II, we became the arsenal of democracy, right? We mobilized industry to build war materials, which we supplied not only to our own armies, but to those of our allies. because, of course, we were the only country amongst the Allies that wasn't under attack, direct attack by enemy forces. So we, government and industry got together and they made deals. You know, you will build a factory for you and you produce tanks. After the war, the factory is yours. And it seemed like a wonderful deal. And in fact, it produced a lot of prosperity after the war was over because they were paying all these people to make tanks. They were piling up the money because everything else, everything that they would buy with that money was rationed. Came 1945 and there was a huge boom in the economy. And the deficits created by defense spending were basically paid off by the economic boom that arose from the cash saved by people during the war that was now being spent on consumer goods. And the factories that were produced or built during the war to produce war material were converted to, you know, instead of tanks, we built automobiles. Instead of warplanes, we built airliners. It worked out pretty well. But the model that was put into place where the government subsidizes industry to produce military equipment never went away. And it never went away because the politics of the Cold War, basically. But now you have a situation where the defense industry is largely bought and paid for by the federal government. They have no other customers. And it's much larger than it probably needs to be, because its lobbyists defend the portion of the federal budget that goes to it. And just to give you an example of how this works, in 1947, the Armed Services Procurement Act, this was right after the war, required the Defense Department to submit all of its purchases to competitive bidding. But by the middle of the 1980s, with Reagan's defense buildup, only 6% of all weapons contracts were put out for bids. The result was that almost half of the Defense Department's budget, $150 billion a year, was available to the defense industry on a cost-plus basis, ensuring the contractors substantial profits at little or no risk. And if you want to know why, you know, the $600 toilet seat or the bomber that cost $2 billion a copy, you don't have to look any further than this. Than cost plus, exactly, and no bid.
And nobody auditing the situation until we find out that the toilet costs $600.
And not only that, what you have is consolidation in the industry, and the industry's and the government's revolving door, where you go from being an executive of the industry to being, a Defense Department person who passes on contracts, and then you go back to the defense industry afterwards. What you've done is you've integrated the defense industry and the government, and the defense industry has claims on federal tax revenues that can't be controlled. You've created an entire industry feedback loop with the government. That's why, for example, Halliburton gets a contract to provide facilities to the American military in Afghanistan or Iraq, and nobody else even bids on it. The reason is because Halliburton has converted itself into a company which supplies these things to the military, and there's no other company in the world that can compete with it because it was created for precisely that purpose.
It's huge, and so
it's enormous.
It's not like you can compete with a little startup. The other thing, Bill, is that I've heard is that there's a defense.
They have a defense plant in every state, and they lobby not only the federal government but the state legislature. I mean, one critic, senator from Iowa, Senator Grassley, said defense contractors are the new welfare queens, isolated from competition and the consequences of their mistakes, and with the government always ready to bail them out.
Oops, that cost $2 billion more than we thought.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, that's right. If you want the airplane, we'll need, 20% more funding to complete the electronic warfare systems on the plane.
But we're building airplanes the military doesn't even want, right? Because we can't stop this.
We can't stop this, no, because it's too heavily defended. The industry lobbies are too strong. So, there's the no-bid contract problem, and then there's also arms sales subsidies. We've converted our defense industry into a global industry. And according to the Cato industry, more than half of U.S. weapons sales are now being financed by taxpayers instead of foreign arms purchasers. The way this works is we give Israel or Egypt a bunch of foreign aid to procure modern weapons, and then we require that those weapons be purchased from the United States.
And most people have an exaggerated view of how much foreign aid we're giving. We're giving people money to buy American stuff, right?
Yeah, listen to this. During the fiscal year 1996, that's the last year we have figures from, the government spent $7.9 billion to U.S. companies to help market weapons, and they secured just over $12 billion in agreements for new international arms sales. So the annual $7.9 billion in subsidies included taxpayer loans, grants, and government promotional activities that helps U.S. weapons makers sell their products to foreign customers. So the government is spending $7.9 billion to produce $12 billion in sales. And of the $12 billion in sales that they produce, most of that is financed by foreign aid. So the government is basically a direct subsidy to the defense industry by the United States government. It's a totally risk-free environment for them. So, the question is, isn't the tail wagging the dog? I mean, we are talking about national security here, but what we've instead is created this kind of profit extraction monster that none of us can control. We can't even audit defense expenditures. It's too complicated. They've never been able to produce an audit of what they're spending on what. And now with Homeland Security adding a whole new layer of no-bid contracts, you have to wonder if there's going to be anything left in the Treasury. No wonder they want to cut Social Security and Medicare.
Wow. Well, let's take one last industry, and let's turn to Chuck and talk about the industry that helped cause the huge recession that we're just crawling our way out of hand over hand. And that's the financial industry, which Chuck worked in for many, many years. Well, I think he was kind of on the other side of what we're talking about here.
I admit to being on the other side. I was chief financial officer of the affiliate of a larger bank holding company. And, of course, accounting was one of the departments that reported to me. And my assignment from the holding company was produce zero tax liability. It's complicated how you can do that, but yes, you basically don't, if you're in a bank, you don't really pay any taxes, assuming you have some overseas branches. So let me give you a hypothetical. If we have a branch in the Cayman Island, and it's providing services to the affiliate in Arizona or wherever, it charges a whole lot for that activity. But the services that we provide to them, we charge very little for. That moves the profit from here up there. But remember, there's two sets of books. So that's only the tax set of books that creates all this movement of money around in the overseas profitability in low places. And Apple is, by the way, not just finance industry, Apple is a master of this. But you want your profits to be for tax purposes in an area where you don't have tax liability, but you don't report that to the shareholders. It's all secret information. The IRS cannot disclose any of this information. It's illegal.
Right. Explain that again. How does this work? How does this particular scam work?
Well, I don't know for Apple, but for banks, you just get to decide what affiliates charge each other for things. So you charge high prices, moving profits, because That would make it more profitable in an affiliate with a low tax like the Cayman Island, and vice versa. So you just move money around. That's just one of the many subsidies.
You can charge whatever you want in order to ship money around. You don't pay
subsidiaries in France because the French tax.
You lose money in any place with French, a high tax.
French have confiscatory corporate tax.
Yeah. So the end result of this kind of manipulation is, these very large banking companies pay very low tax rates, lower than you as an individual would. And
that's
great. We were very happy to do that. You know, we got more money for the shareholders. That was our job to do that. I'm not saying it's unethical from the standpoint. It's just that's how they've created the law, and we helped create the tax law. We have our lobbyists up there.
But you got plenty back, didn't you?
Yes.
And but so, it's not really if the system is there to do this, when you're working for the corporation, then your job is to do what your job is to get the – or they'll just replace you
We didn't commit any tax fraud. I mean, there is a line in which you can't cross. But if anything's ambiguous, you go ahead and do it, and they don't have an enforcement mechanism adequate to audit your Cayman branch, for example.
I don't think they understand what the finance industry is doing any more than they understand what the defense industry is doing. They can't really see into it well enough to know what's going on until much afterward.
And they've done us the favor year after year of reducing the enforcement staff at the IRS. So as a result, we have even less likely to get audited. And if we do, they're unlikely to be by people with the competency to figure all this out. So in effect, corporate taxes for large companies, for international companies, are just a matter of them deciding how much they want to pay. But usually they decide to pay very little.
And in fact, that is a subsidy. It isn't defined as one, but that's in fact what it is. Because if they were paying what the nominal tax rate should be, the federal treasury would be on the plus side rather than on the minus side, which it currently is.
So they shifted the money to Cayman Islands as an example, just like Romney would, for the same reason.
Yes,
a very wealthy individual.
And that's another finance. Romney is a perfect example of another benefit of the tax code. Hedge fund managers and people who were employed like Romney, those gains are treated as long-term capital gains to a person. As a result, they're taxed at 15%, as opposed to the maximum individual tax rate is 39.5. So he's cut his tax liability in more than in half.
Which is the most, here, gentlemen, we have a couple of minutes left. What is the most irrationally subsidized industry in the United States? Chuck, Bill?
I think some of the very best examples, we don't really have time to cover, municipal ones. But the most outrageous one I was able to discover for municipalities had to do with the New York Stock Exchange threatening to move to New Jersey. Well, as you know how the New York Stock Exchange works, firstly, every member of the exchange is a wealthy Manhattanite who lives on the Upper East Side in a $5 million condo. They're not going to commute to New Jersey. That never would have happened. But we had a mayor in New York who
Giuliani,
who wanted to keep them there, and he bowed to the extortion to the extent of $900 million in subsidies. And that's the largest
and that's
municipal
the city.
Scam in history.
That's the city. $900 million.
Oh, there's lots.
You can't top that, Bill.
There's lots more, folks. We haven't even talked about agricultural price supports yet. Maybe another show.
We do need to do another show on this. Not a lot of announcements. Dora and Dove's Democrats of the Red Rocks and Democrats of the Verde Valley provide some support for this show. Rest of it comes from individuals. There's an immigration forum that Dora is having this Thursday, and there are five different speakers, immigration attorneys, a young dreamer, Barbara Luttrell, who's the city council. City councilor will be chairing it. It's this Thursday, and the doors open at 7:45, and it's at the Jewish community of Sedona and the Verde Valley. Doors breakfasts are usually at the old Sedona Bar and Grill, come early. They promise really, really good food. And this is a kind of an exciting forum. Lots of interesting people. We will interview them and maybe pre-record them for a show on Democratic Perspective. We'll have to rush over here, and we need police escort, I think. But other than that, so we've got a minute left.
Not really.
Well, I was going to ask Bill for his example. I don't think he's going to top Chuck on subsidies here. So join us next week. We've got a good program coming up. BVID.org. All of our work is on podcasts.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.